All right, as I mentioned last week, tonight's lesson, we won't be reading the entire text because it covers two full chapters, but we will be looking at an overview of chapters 2 and 3. Before we begin tonight, just a note, Joe has offered to give away some small booklets about the book of Revelation. If you would like one of them, see Brother Joe afterwards, and he can tell you about those. But are they from Herald of Hope?
Yes, they're from Herald of Hope. Okay. They're a good little study, but I've got lots of pictures, and I know how hard it is to understand Revelation, and I know that the pastor will not be able to do a full, real study of it, but these are really good guides to understanding Revelation. And, just have a look and talk to me later, and I can show you. Useful tools in helping you to understand.
Okay, good. So if you'd like one of those, you see Joe afterwards, and he'd be happy to help you with that. All right, so tonight we're going to be looking at just an overview of these two chapters. And the reason that I've chosen to do an overview is because the content of these chapters, as I said, in years gone by, I've preached through Revelation several times over the years of my ministry here. And I found that, the first two or three weeks it goes okay, and then there's a lot of repeating things in it, and it was really bogged down, and it made it, a challenge to get through all seven of them. And they're not all the same. They are, each one has different things to it, and we'll be looking at some of that tonight. So I just want to give you kind of a challenge to read through them on your own and dig into that and examine that. And then once we get into chapter 4, we're going to start spending a whole evening on one chapter and just delve into that. But these chapters are, chapters 1 and 2 are kind of an insertion between two visions. All right, we saw in verse chapter 1 there was a vision of Christ. He's the head of the local churches. And then in chapter 4 we see a vision of the 24 elders representing the glorified church. So there's two different visions. And this is kind of in the middle of it, in between these, so this is an insertion in there. And we'll find that throughout the book of Revelation. There's several places where John will pause, the Spirit of God paused as he was explaining that to John, and would give an insertion. All right, the insertion is the instruction for the local churches there in Asia. All right, so there's these seven churches in Asia. I'm going to give you a map in just a moment here to see where they were located. But it included praise, rebuke, and exhortation. So each one of these churches, there's a word of praise, there's a word of rebuke, there's a word of exhortation. And some of them be capitalized more on one than the other. We're not, as I said, we're not going to take the time to examine it in detail tonight. And I'd encourage you to just read through those and see that on your own study. Now here's a map of the area here, and you'll see, of course, Israel's over here, Jerusalem and the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee, and then Egypt down here. So you can just kind of get your gears together. Some of you aren't map-oriented people. And then the gospel started here in Antioch. That was Paul's home church, not where he grew up. He grew up in Tarsus over here. But Antioch was, remember, where they sent out first Paul and Barnabas, and then later they sent out Paul and Silas from there. And these are the churches over there. In the area of Turkey, of this area here is Turkey. The earthquake that just took place was right up in this area. So it's in this area here. But here's the seven churches here. Athens is in there just for a point of reference. So you can see those seven churches that are listed there for our understanding. Okay, any questions about the map? Okay, I'm not going to come back to that, but I just wanted you to see where they are so you can kind of see that. Now, the literal view of Revelation, the seven churches, I believe, are literal churches. All right, so when he's writing to these churches in chapter 2, he starts out with, in verse number 1, writing to the church of Ephesus. And in chapter 1, verse 8, he writes to the church of Smyrna. Chapter 2, verse 8. And 2, verse 12 is the church of Pergamos. And 2, verse 18 is the church of Thyatira. And then chapter 3, verse 1 is Sardis. And chapter 3, verse 7 is Philadelphia. 3:14 is Laodicea. All right, so you got the seven churches there. And he gives information on there. And each one of those, he he gives them similar charges, and it's a repeated thing, but he ends each one of them with a challenge to those who will be the overcomers. All right, so that's an important thing for us to note there. Now, the churches were located there in Asia. We just saw that on our map. And many Christians believe that these churches represent seven ages of time since the first century until now. We will consider this parabolic view in a few moments. All right, now, I must tell you right up front, that's not what I learned in Bible college. And so for, you know, I was taught that it was a literal one, not the representation of ages. And both views are probably valid views. They're interpretations. There's different ideas. The Bible doesn't say specifically which is right. Obviously, if it did, then there wouldn't be a controversy over it. All right? But we'll look briefly at both of them so you can see what they are, and then you can evaluate it from there. True churches have existed since the time of Christ during the Dark Ages when the Catholic Church dominated the world. True biblical churches existed in secret. They were known by numerous names. All right, now, here's a map for us to see of the time span there. You can see the dates are at the top and at the bottom, so you can get that. Understand that the blue is the vastness of the church age. If you kids want to come over and sit in the soft chair here, you can get a better view. You don't have to crank your head. It's a nice, soft, cozy. Indica's sick tonight, can't make it. But then the yellow is the Dark Ages. That was a time of immense persecution from the Catholic Church. And then you see the Catholic Church here split in 869 to the Greek and the Roman Catholic Churches. And then during the Reformation period, Luther began it in 1530. And then breakoffs that resulted from that, the Church of England and the Methodist Church eventually, and then the Presbyterians and the Congregationalists all came as a result of the Reformation here. Then the cults, the Mormons and Jehovah's Witnesses and Seventh-day Adventists were all here in the mid-1800s, all started in America. 1830, the Mormons, 1844, the SDAs, and 1870, the Jehovah's Witnesses. All right, so that kind of gives you an overview. Now, in the blue section here, all right, I just mentioned a moment ago that there were churches that were underground churches, hidden from, you know, they had to hide because of the persecution. And a lot of these churches, they spread over this period of time. The Donatists and the Monophysites and the Novatians, Politians, Bogomils, Peterines and the Albigenses, the Peterbrucians and the Waldensians and the Anabaptists, Baptists, and so on. All right. Now, there was probably a lot more other than that. A lot of them were named after the man who was kind of the pastor of their group. But they were, most of them, especially during the Dark Ages, had to meet in secret in order to keep from being killed. And persecution was worse in some areas than others. But that gives you an idea that there have been churches, you know, sometimes people say, well, we all came out of the Reformation. And, you know, even I read in some Baptist Union literature, they say, well, we all came from the Reformation. Well, I don't believe that at all. But that would imply that there was no true church for all those years, and the Catholic Church was the only church. Well, the Catholic Church wasn't the true church. And so I don't believe that we came from this. I believe we came from an ancestry of a lot of different groups. Many of them believe much like we do. To say that they all believe identical to us would be impossible to prove, first of all, and probably an exaggeration. I don't think they were all identical to us. But they had a lot of things in common with us as far as salvation by faith in Christ and biblical baptism and things of that nature. So down through the years. And then they were first called Anabaptists. The word Anna. Anybody know what the word Anna means?
I don't know.
What's that?
No baptism.
No. It doesn't mean Anna means again. If it was a Baptist, it would be no. But Anna means again. That's all right. At least you give it a try. Nobody else is brave enough to try. All right? So the Anabaptists, they got that name from their enemies because they said, you're baptizing them again. They've already been baptized as a kid in a baby. Why would you baptize them again? And so they called him Anabaptist. They baptized him again. And then eventually that Anna just got dropped off and they just called him Baptist. So that's where our ancestry comes from. And so it gives you a little bit of a better view of where it all fits in there and weaves through. And all most of us through, well, obviously the area there, Europe and on over into the northern areas of, you know, Turkey and Italy and all those countries, and Romania and all those countries up in there. Okay? So that's where. Any questions about this? Yes, ma'am.
I think maybe the Huguenots should be up there as well.
Yeah, they should be. Yeah. Yeah, Huguenots were in there as well. Yeah. So there's like I said, there's probably lots of other names, but these are some of the main ones. As you were, if you would study through history, these would be some of the main ones you'd find. Gerard?
The one that says Christians, is that referring to the early, the first Christians of the church?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Down on the far end. Yes. So that would be, remember they were first called Christians at Antioch? So that's what we're referring to there. Joe?
And how would you apply all this to the seven churches?
Well, this doesn't apply to the seven churches. All I'm saying is that there have always been, let me back up to the previous screen, down at the bottom here, I'm building up to something here. The reason is because with the view that the churches are ages, the Church of Thyatira is the one that they say is the Catholic Church. And so the Catholic Church would be their true church during all that ages. Well, I don't believe that. I believe that there always were biblical churches. It wasn't just the Catholic Church that was the church of those ages. And as I looked at even some of the literature that you gave me there, that they have the Catholic Church was kind of in charge of all this.
Yeah.
Yes, I understand. No, I understand that. I understand that. And then they say that several of the other ones go on. And so we'll look at that in just a moment. But that's why I brought this up, to show that there were always biblical churches. It wasn't just the Catholic Church that was the church there. So, but just a quick look at the parabolic view. I've called it David Cloud. Some of you may be familiar with him. He's written extensively on a lot of different apologetic issues. And he's got a great website. But he said here that, number one, the messages were given to instruct the particular churches to which they were addressed. All right, so with the seven churches here, it was a message to instruct those particular churches. All right, and then the messengers, the messages were given to instruct all churches. The instruction given to the seven churches of Asia in the first century applies to every church in every century. He gives scripture references there to support his point. And then each church that has ever existed is similar to one of these seven churches. All right, so this is one way of looking at this. His view is not the specific that they mean, refer to different ages, but it's kind of a blend between the two. And he's saying there that each one of these have messages for all of us. And I believe that's true. It's just like when Paul wrote Ephesians, or he wrote Philippians, or he wrote Colossians, or Romans, yes, he wrote it to a specific group of people, but there was information there that can be of help to all of us who know Christ our Savior. And so even in the Old Testament, some things that were not written to any specific people, we can still gain principles from that. All right, so David Cloud goes on. He says the messages were given to instruct individual believers. And every believer can find a wealth of edification and spiritual challenge and warning in these messages. All right, so he's just saying there's stuff there for all of us. We can gain from it, and we can benefit from those messages. And then he concludes here that the messages offer a general overview of church history. This is not the main lesson of these chapters, and I believe that any approach that focuses exclusively or even largely on this aspect is wrong. This is the mistake made by Harry Ironside in his commentary on Revelation. My approach is entirely different. While I devote five pages of my commentary to the typical approach, I devote 84 pages to the practical application. All right, so his view of this is, like I said, it's kind of a blend of the two. We're going to look at the next one. This is more of how the Herald of Hope would present it, and that is that many Bible teachers believe that the seven churches represent seven stages of history. All right, so they'd say the first one was the apostolic time, and then there was a period where it deals with the next two centuries, and then the next one deals with three centuries, and then the next one is Thyatira, which picks up the Catholic Church, and that carries on. And in their interpretation, they say that the last four continue on until the rapture. But that's just their interpretation, because none of that is in the Scriptures, and that's why I struggle to accept that kind of a view, but that is what they believe. Now, some think that the last four represent ages, as I just said, they continue on to the rapture. Though John does not call the churches stages of history, many of the speculations make sense. I have to admit, you read that literature, and it doesn't make sense. You know, they say, well, the Church of Ephesus is dealing with the Church of the Apostolic Age, and you read through it and say, well, yeah, it kind of makes good sense. And you look at the Smyrna, and they say that's the next two centuries, and that kind of makes good sense. But there's nothing in the text that says that it represents ages, but it might. It might, and I'm not saying it doesn't. That's, like I said, right from the very start, that's not what I was taught. And so, you know, once you've been taught something, it's hard to get your head around something different. But I can certainly see that there's some evidence, some possibilities there. They also claim that the churches are not true, that many in the churches are not true believers, but that only the overcomers mentioned at the end of each of the message of the churches are the true believers. And I can see that makes sense too. Right? He mentions each time he talks about he that overcometh shall inherit this, or he that overcometh and shall, you know, some sort of a promise to the overcomers. So
all Christians are overcomers, right?
Yes. Yeah, the true believers. They've overcome the devil through salvation in Christ. All right, now, the literal view, and we'll kind of review over that in just a moment. I personally do not believe that the seven churches represent the ages of time. That view has several problems, and here's some of the reasons. Number one, John did not state that the churches were symbolic in the text. There's nothing in the text that says these are ages to come. There's nothing that indicates that. As I said, there are some, you know, you look through it and their arguments do kind of line up, and you think, well, yeah, that's a coincidence, and it may be. And honestly, folks, if you believe that, that's fine. I don't see that it makes any difference, but as I said, I don't personally see it that way. John addressed specific problems present in each one of the local churches. So each time he addressed one of those churches, he's talking to them about particular problems that they had and they struggled with. He wasn't dealing with, you know, six centuries down in the future. He was dealing with that local church. If not literal, the prophecy could not have been understood in John's day. So this is another real big problem. If this is really stretched over, you know, well, it's been almost 2,000 years. If that's the way it was intended to be and it was expressing all of that, then really much of what John had written here wouldn't make any sense because it was yet centuries away. So then John would have known hundreds of years had to pass before these things could come to be. And then the parabolic view implies that the Church of Thyatira represents a heretical Catholic Church as the true church for many centuries, while biblical testament, New Testament churches met in secret. And that's probably my biggest trouble with that view, is that I do not believe that the Catholic Church represents the Church of Thyatira. I really struggle with that because the Catholic Church is so far from biblical in so many different ways. Now, whether the seven churches represented the ages or not, the prophecy of the book is not changed either way. Well, I really want to emphasize this last point here, because if you believe in that the seven churches represent ages, that's fine. They might. I could be wrong. I've learned things that were wrong before. If I'm right and that's wrong, it doesn't make any difference because it doesn't change the message of the book. It may change how you view those seven churches, but it's not going to change the message of the book as we look continuing on. Garrett?
Yeah. I once met some people and said to tape, they were just walking. Like, I don't know what they were doing. They were just walking around talking to people, basically. But I feel like they had this weird view of that we're still in the apostle stage and still doing miracles and still pretty much doing exactly what the apostles did. They even like were saying we're like God's apostles and like to get around doing all this stuff. They kind of had this view that that stage is still continuing until Christ comes back. Odd.
What he's trying to say is that it's past. That is not, there's no apostles now.
Yeah.
So it's got a historical sort of an idea, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's a different setting. Yeah, and like I said, there are. I mean, as you read through the material, like the Herald of Hope has, it does, honestly, there are a lot of very logical explanations of how they can apply to these things. Chester,
as far as I understand, the Church of Rome has been corrupt from the start to now.
Yes.
So what century are they saying that it wasn't corrupt?
Well, they're not necessarily saying it wasn't corrupt. They're just saying that was the church that was represented by Thyatira. And that's why I struggle with that, because I don't...
A very corrupt church is kind of like an oxymoron.
Yeah.
Yeah, but one can say, are there no Christians saved in the Catholic Church? That would be a wrong idea, wouldn't it? There's always remnants in a lot of churches.
Well, but there's a lot of history to back up the bloodshed of the Roman Catholic Church,
Well, the Dark Ages was all about the Catholic Church. There was no other real church going on. Well, there was other churches, like you mentioned, all those, but they were the church that persecuted the Christians.
So anyway, it doesn't really change the way that we look at the book of Revelation. Once we're past chapter 3, then from that point on, the seven churches are not mentioned in that same light. And so I just want you to see that. Now let's just take a look at some aspects regarding the seven churches here that we can benefit from. All right? Some good characteristics and bad characteristics, right, of these, each one that was, when they were addressed in these passages here. Ephesus, he mentions their good character in verses 2 and 6. And then he mentions their loss of love in verse number 4. All right? That's of chapter 2. And in verse number 4 there, he says, "Nevertheless, I have someone against thee, because thou hast left thy first love." All right, so here's the commendation and the rebuke for the church of Ephesus. With Smyrna, there is the commendation of godly suffering in verse number 9. But as you look through there, you don't find anything of any bad characteristics. God doesn't say anything negative about the church of Smyrna. He only says the positive thing about them. As you looked in at Pergamos, they in verse number 13 of chapter 2, they take a faithful stand and do what's right. And then in verses 14 and 15, he deals with their bad doctrine, some of the bad doctrine that had come in. He talks about their doctrine of Balaam and how that he had caused people to stumble. And then he talks about the Nicolaitans and some of these things. And so some of the bad doctrine that they had there. So there's the good and the bad for Pergamos. And then the church of Thyatira, he mentions their good works in verse number 19. Right, verse number 19, "I know thy works, and thy charity, and thy service, and thy faith, and thy patience, and thy works, and the last are more than the first." All right, so here he commends them of good things. Now, again, see, there's where I really struggle to call the church, the Catholic Church, the Thyatira Church. That doesn't describe them, all right? Not in my understanding of it. So that's, like I said, that's the number one main reason that I struggle with that view. But I could be wrong, okay? So here he says that they had good works, but then they tolerated Jezebel in verse number 20, and there's lots of interpretations of what that refers to. Obviously, Jezebel was not good, and they tolerated that. Jordan?
Well, just randomly thinking like the Pergamus, do you think that's kind of what a Catholic Church gets the whole, well, I don't know if it's a Catholic Church, but whoever gets the purgatory thing from? Because in the verses below, you're talking about where Satan dwells, and you dwell where Satan dwells.
I don't think so.
I just thought maybe.
Joe, have you ever heard anything like that, that Pergamus had anything to do with purgatory?
No.
No, I don't think so.
It probably doesn't. Just in the verses where it talks about the Savior, where Satan
dwells. Well, they more the word purge.
Yes, I think you're right. The idea of purgatory was a place of purging of their sins. So that's probably a much better explanation for it. Thanks. Okay, and then the church of Sardis, he compliments them for being alive, having a lively reputation, but then he rebukes them for their dead reality. They had an appearance of being alive, but they in reality were rather dead. And then the church of Philadelphia, they kept the word, verses 8 and 10, chapter 3, but there's nothing negative said about them as well. All right, so that's very interesting that he does this. And then the last one, the church of Laodicea, there's nothing good said about them, but they're lukewarm. And so from the perspective of different ages or that kind of thing, they would say that these last four represent churches that are still in existence today. But from the view that David Cloud presented, he would say that all of these have, there's things in each of these that are true. I mean, there's lots of people that have lost their first love for the Lord. And there's bad doctrine in heaps of churches today. And, you know, there's lots of people that are tolerating things like Jezebel and that. So there's principles there. There's applications that could apply to all of them. So whether or not we look at them from age perspectives or we just see it as something else. Yes, sir?
I just want to make sure I haven't got colorblind. It's just the orange is actually green. Well, the orange is actually green. Green is written in green, and orange is written in green.
Yeah, because I was hoping I'm wondering, am I not being confused with my color?
All right. Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought that out, John. Right? All right, I'll tell you what happened. Okay, here's what happened. I goofed. I'm not colorblind. I do know the difference. All right, what it was is. All right, I'll fix it. Okay, here's what happened. When I chose the color theme for this, all right, these things were linked to one of the colors, and when you change the theme, it changes the color. And I didn't catch the fact that the green turned or orange turned green. Yeah, so I do know the difference. Okay. Yeah, I know. Same pastor thinks orange is red and, or green is red and orange. Okay.
Sardis, 3:1-6.
Yes.
Dying, that one, life, reputation, and death, reality. What
the... Okay, let's just take a look at that in chapter 3 and verse number 1. All right, chapter 3 and verse number 1. It says, unto the angel of the church of Sardis write, these things saith he that hath the seven spirits of God and the seven stars. I know thy works, that thou hast a name, that thou livest and are dead. All right? So he said, I know you have a reputation for being alive, but in reality, I know you're dead. And you know, there's a lot of churches like that today that have, you know, that on the outside, they look like they're alive, but in reality, they're spiritually dead. And that's what he's talking about there. Okay? Good?
Just on top of that, I heard somebody make this weird. I think they were interpreting it very strangely, but they were just having the view that the verse in the Bible where it says having a form of godliness with the ninth works, but he was saying that he thinks that it's Christians today that deny God's power. And again, he was going on about like how we're still meant to. They're talking about like people are leaving, casting out demons and all stuff, and he was saying that a lot. That he thinks that's what the verse is talking about. People are dead dead because they deny God's power. Not they're religious, but they don't deny God.
I can see where they would come up with. Well, I can see where they'd come up with that kind of an interpretation,
well,
but
that's just the view. That's just your opinion.
And that's there's a lot of things of that nature that we need to guard against. All right, anything else on these before we move on? Okay, so then just some personal applications here. From these churches, we see that God wants us to, number one, keep our love for Him passionate. All right, so as you look at those churches and as you read through those, and I encourage you to do that. Just it'd take you a few minutes, just read through those two chapters there. But you see there that there's a challenge to keep our love passionate. Remember, especially right there at the start when he says that they've lost their first love. And there's a lot of debate over what the first love is, and that, that's another whole study. But we need to have a proper love for the Lord. And then we need to live for eternal riches, instead of just personal riches or earthly riches. We need to live for what's ahead and to keep our eyes on the Lord. And then to refuse compromise. There's a lot of compromise mentioned in these churches that they did right, but they also did a lot of wrong. They tolerated people that were doing wrong. And then guard against false teachings. That's a tough one. In order to guard against false teachings, what do we need to know? Truth. Exactly. All right? And that's one of the reasons why so many professing Christians fall for the cults, because they don't know truth. And then the cults come along and they persuade them that they have a right interpretation of it. Right? And then we need to have a living relationship with Christ. That is so important. And we all know that, but it's something that takes work. Everything that's alive and living takes work to keep it that way. Right? And then we need to speak boldly for Christ, be a good testimony for Him, and stay on fire for the Lord. John? Yes,
I was just going to ask.
Yep.
The Sardinia that we read, I'm just curious, is that Sardis, is that what modern-day Sardinia is? That is a place that you're called Sardinia. I was just wondering if that's...
Go back to the map,
maybe. Oh, no, I was just curious, because it's just more of a geography question.
I couldn't answer that. I don't know.
So it's not nothing to do with Sardis.
Well, Sardis is in Turkey, but...
Oh, okay, so probably nothing to do with it.
Okay. I'm can't help you there, but Peter seems to know where the other place is.
I'm just trying to picture where it's over there.
Okay, so a different location.
Just trying to picture where the light is.
Okay, now, I'll take you back to the map in just a second here. This is the last thing here. Do these qualities describe your life? That's one of the things we really need to. And when we apply these things, as you read through these two chapters and evaluate some of these things that are being discussed and addressed here, we need to ask ourselves, do these qualities describe us? And if not, they could, and they should, and God is standing at the door of our hearts knocking, and He wants us to open the door. All right, so it's a challenge for us to ponder that. All right, now let me just back up here. And I think the fastest way to back up is to step out of this. And I'll take us back to it and come back to you. Okay? Otherwise, I'll have to scroll back through a zillion of these things. Okay. Okay, so here's your map.
Oh, yeah, that's...
All right? So this is all Turkey here. You got water that comes up in here. And this Greece over here, Italy over there. Okay, so Peter, you said that place was in Italy?
Yeah, this is that
island. So that's way over there.
Sardinia, that island, yeah, that's Sardinia, I suppose.
Underneath Sicily.
The one shop from over there.
The boot keeps Sicily and Sardinia is
that
little... Oh, over there.
No, it's just right. It doesn't matter.
It's not the same place anyway, that's all that matters.
It's so confusing because so many places that were called things back then have places and other places today that have very similar names. And that's what makes it so confusing. Like trying to think of today's context and then trying to think of the ancient context.
Yeah, that's similar to like Europe and America, because a lot of the settlers that went from America went over to America, they took European names, and then you got Boston and America.
Isn't it?
Yeah, there's Athens, there's Boston, there's all kinds of ones. So.